everyone. I'm Gary Null. Nice to have you with us today. We're going to talk about how a Mediterranean diet is really good, but not if it's not organic. I'll explain. But more importantly today, we're going to be hearing from a tenured professor, outstanding 20-plus career years at an Ontario university, who has just been fired. Now, she's published in the peer-reviewed journal. She's attended conferences. Her work is highly respected. She's a scholar on medical ethics. And yet she was fired for medical ethics. She stood up for them because she said it is not right to demand that people be vaccinated or lose their job, especially when, as you will hear her talk, that people may have legitimate medical underlying health issues that would prevent him from safely taking the vaccine. And she's pro-vaccine. In fact, just so you understand, everyone that I've had on this program to discuss these issues for the last year and a half or more is pro-vaccine. So we're going to hear from her. What she has to say is very enlightening. But we always begin with the latest in health and healing. The Mediterranean diet may not only be healthy if it's organic. That's Southern Cross University, which is in Australia, and also the University of Oslo, which is in Norway. A new study has found that adopting a healthy Mediterranean diet significantly increases your pesticide intake, while changing to organic food consumption led to a substantial decrease in pesticide exposure. Now, mind you, we are flooded with pesticides and have been for a long time. When I go to the farmer's market, I always look at fresh, great. Support local farming, absolutely. But I'm not going to buy anything if it's not organic, or there are things you can buy that are non-organic that are not polluted. For example, you could buy avocados. It's insignificant if they're organic because the shell on the avocado protects the inside fruit. That's also true with nuts. And hence, we're frequently overpaying for organic nuts when the shell substantially protects the nut inside. There are other things as well. But for strawberries and for lettuces, you bet it should be organic. And that's why one of the most popular selling items in the supermarket today are those. I'm sure you've seen them. They come in different sizes. The boxes of microgreens, the boxes of sprouts, and the boxes of organic, and these are all organic lettuces, small lettuces, baby lettuces, spring mix, they call them. More and more people are aware, I don't want pesticides in my body. Pesticides cause cancer. It may take 10, 20, 30, 40 years, but they do cause cancer. And if you have cancer, which many Americans do, or have overcome cancer, which we're happy to hear, then you really want to be on a clean diet. So when I say we should be on a healthy, clean, plant-based diet, it means organic, wherever possible. So that's what this Western, this diet was about. Now, when you go to the Mediterranean, I'm sure many of you have been to the Mediterranean, it should be on everyone's bucket list. First, because the people are just wonderful. There's so much culture and history. I was actually in a farmhouse in Italy, in the Alps, and the farmhouse was 800 years old, and the same lineage, generation after generation, had lived there that whole time. I spent the day working with people in their garden, which was up the side of a hill. It was a wonderful experience, and I was training for another marathon at the time, and this 93-year-old man who had an apron on, and the apron had a big, imagine if you were wearing a pillowcase, and you just, as you went up the hill, squatting, pulling vegetables and putting them into the bag. And he did that from morning until lunchtime. And then later after that, huge legs, strong as can be. I'm a marathoner and I'm tired. I'm sore. I'm having to keep up with him, you know, to not embarrass myself. And they just smiled. So they only eat organic. Contrary to what you may believe, people throughout the world know the dangers of pesticides. They've seen it. They've seen it in their livestock. They've seen it in people handling pesticides who end up getting lesions on the skin and sores that don't heal. So organic is a very big thing throughout the world. Not so much in the United States, but it's becoming more popular. So just an idea, increase your intake of fruits and vegetables. Absolutely. I believe we're far undertaking. I believe we should be consuming about 13 servings a day of fruits and vegetables, and especially your cruciferous vegetables, broccoli, cauliflower, Brussels sprouts, asparagus, kale, mustard greens, radishes, mustard itself, very good. But remember, if it's not organic, you can have a 300% increase in higher organophosphate and insecticide intake. And you don't want the fungicides, the herbicides that are on fruits and vegetables. Also, let's just say you have to buy something that's not organic. Then, in which case, buy yourself what is called a veggie wash. There are many different brands. And you spray it on the fruit, massage it completely, then you wash it off. But let's say you just don't have that. Okay, take some apple cider vinegar and put it into water and then agitate your fruits, vegetables, salad greens and turn it over. So what I do is let's say I've got some grapes and I wash the grapes and then I rub them. You know, it's that agitation between your hands and fingers that loosens the little debris and then you wash it off. I do this with organic because organic also means that it can be, you can have some bacteria in there that you don't want in your body, E. coli, for example. Anyhow, that's important. Now, next up, I'm sure you've heard by now the 5-2 diet. It's a good choice for gestational diabetes, according to the University of South Australia. So now new research from the University of South Australia suggests that the popular 5-2 diet, you would know it by the intermittent fasting diet, is just as effective as conventional energy-restricting diet, enabling women greater choice and flexibility when it comes to weight loss. The 5.2 diet allows 5 days of normal eating each week and then substantially restrict your calories on the weekend or whatever 2 days you choose, as opposed to a typical diet that requires moderate energy restrictions daily. So the modified fasting diet is terrific for you. Also, and what's most exciting for me, because I've been working nonstop to complete a new documentary. It's been 5 years in the making on anti-aging, and I have over 1,000 hours of footage. So one of our crew, one of the team that helps work on these documentaries, it's a team effort, by the way. I can write and script and direct and travel throughout the world, which I do, but it takes great cinematographer to do that. We have Roland Marconi for that. And you have an outstanding editor for the last, and they both work with me for 35 years. And Valerie Van Cleve, who has won, I guess, somewhere around 100 awards in editing. She takes all that has been done and puts it all together. So when you watch it in a theater, a lot of different people have input. And I just want to give them credit because the best things in life are a team effort. When you work together with other people, and because you get different input. But now I'm doing something that I haven't done before. I'm just going to take an aside, share this with you. In around the 9th of January, I'm going to have a reunion. This is just to bring some of the people who've trained in the Natural Living, Running, and Walking Club that was started on July 4th, 1975, on the boardwalk out in Brooklyn. 5,000 plus people showed up. I know that because we were asking people in advance. We didn't know how many people would show up, and we had to get a permit. I was guesstimating 50 to 100 people, and it was over 5,000. So I made up T-shirts. I don't know if any of you still have the T-shirt, but it had a runner on the front, and We gave them all out, and there were still several hundred people didn't get them. One of the people who showed up that day was a man named Sid Howard. Sid's a wonderful human being. He's 80 years of age now. And from shortly after he got into running till now, he's the world's greatest senior miler. He was the world's greatest master miler. Him and one other gentleman. He's won Athlete of the Year so many times, not even counting. So I wanted to see about all the people I've trained, over 90,000. Some of you will remember coming to Central Park and there'd be 900 people there on a Sunday. We had hundreds running the marathon, over 32,000 have run it. But what happens to them? You know, how long does a person stay in a group? We found that in the 1980s, I just did the analysis of this, an average of about 3 years if they were running the marathon, or three marathons, and then you don't see them again. And I guess they continue their training wherever they live. They came from the whole tri-state area. But what about the people who want to become more elite athletes? Well, that time is generally around 10 years they stick with the group, and until they move, but you always see them in the park, and they're always the best in the world. Louise Nottage, Thelma Wilson, Queenie Thompson, Sam Skinner, Sid Howard. In fact, Sid Howard and Sam Skinner and I, of all the running clubs, over 115 running clubs in New York, we took the medal in the 10K relay 2 years in a row. We did it. So these are experiences you never forget. When you bond with someone and you win, you never forget that moment. But then someone recently asked me that I met at the farmer's market here, does he remember when we did the London Marathon? I said, sure. Wonderful experience. About 60 of us went over. And he talked about what it was like, how exciting he was to do the marathon, all the people. Recently saw Chariots of Fire, and it depressed him because the opening scene, because I was there I couldn't get close to him. There were thousands of other athletes in the first London Marathon. By the way, the people that trained with me, we did the first marathons. We did the first Montreal Marathon, Jamaica Marathon, London, Paris, Waterfront, Jersey Shore, Long Island, Marine Corps Marathon, Los Angeles, San Francisco Marathon. So we did the first of about 20 different marathons. And then sometimes you just don't see people anymore. But you hope they continue being in shape. So he said, why don't you have a reunion and get people motivated again? He said, I need to be motivated. He said, I'm successful in my career, but I'm not motivated. And look at me. And he was really out of shape. And then I started to think, well, I wonder if other people let themselves go. And you see this with professional careers. Even yesterday, when I was watching some of the ball games, the commentators are frequently famous former athletes. And my goodness, wow, Terry Bradshaw, one of the greatest quarterbacks in history, out of shape. I mean, almost all of them were out of shape. Michael Strahan was not out of shape, but most of them are, especially when they're in their 50s, 60s, or 70s. So I thought, gee whiz, what happens in a person's life? What goes on in their mind when they knew that they were the top shape and now they're not? And then I said, we'll do a small reunion. I can't handle a lot of people here. It's free and it's, you know, it's just people coming. And then I realized we start getting the photographs in and the little background on people who train. None of them are in shape. They're all out of shape. So now I'm changing this over to, let's see if we can repurpose our life at different ages to get back into shape. Because I went back to some videos that some of the listeners had done showing dance parties. And I'm guesstimating about 80,000 listeners have attended the 55 dance parties I've done over the year, free, you know, to celebrate the station and to celebrate life. And back in the 1980s, you see all these wonderfully healthy people. Wonder what they look like now. Do they stay in shape? I haven't been in touch with anyone. I'd be curious. In any case, what would happen if we suddenly have an opportunity to redo it all over, starting now, with different ideas, because we're not at the same age where we could not pay attention to our health? There's a point in life where you tip. It's generally in the mid-40s, where if you don't pay attention to what you're eating and drinking and exercising and stressing in the right way rather than the wrong way, you tip into disease, and then you just go downhill from there, and you start to prematurely age. So now I'm going to set up a whole schedule. One of my friends, Mitchell Raven's, coming down, and he's going to teach Qigong, Tai Chi, meditation. I'll go to some classes every day. I'm going out to buy a bunch of bikes so we can go out and bike and see how many miles we can get up to. It'd be great to get up to 50 miles nonstop. The key is nonstop. And then water aerobics and track work and gym, and just see if people can't just start, in effect, start all over again, right? And I'm always excited by the solutions of what happens when you change your perspective, what you can do. And sometimes it takes a support group to help people. Not everyone is a self-starter. But for those who would like to have the next section of their life live without the fear of disease and death, well, that's one way of doing it. Anyhow, that's just an aside. But it leads into this, because in my last anti-aging study, and there were four back to back to back to back, all confirming one to another and adding to the protocols, I made sure that everyone took the same supplements every day. There'd be a table and you'd go in and everybody would be given, this is what you take every day. That way you know everyone's taking the supplements. Like when we do our juices, 15 juices a day, there we have the juices. We have the same meal. We're at the same classes. We're going out to work out the same. So this way we know we're not cheating. Someone's really doing it. And the why? Because the very first one I did, half the people didn't do the protocols. I didn't see what they were doing throughout the day. And then they told, well, I said, why didn't you get better results? Well, the exercise I'm not really into, but that's a very important part of it. Well, I didn't do the supplements. I don't feel comfortable just taking a bunch of vitamins. Well, you could put them in a smoothie. They were giving me excuses, but that skewed the study. And these studies for me are very expensive, very time consuming. So now it's very strict. But one of the nutrients I put in there was a nutrient called resveratrol, R-E-V-E-R-S-A-T-R-O-L. And I explained why each one of those was important to the aging process. And I wouldn't say one is better than another, because we've got some superstars now, including that which can help rejuvenate stem cell. This is the latest study. This is the University of Exeter, just out today. Old human cells rejuvenated in this breakthrough discovery on aging with resveratrol. A team led by Professor Lorna Harris, Professor of Molecular Genetics at the University of Exeter, has discovered a new way to rejuvenate inactive senescent cells. Within hours of treatment, the older cells started to divide and had longer telomeres. The caps, you've heard me say many times, the shoestring, the end caps, that's the telomeres on the chromosomes. And they shorten with age. Well, we don't want shortened. When you sit too long, you shorten them. When you eat a bad diet, you shorten them. When you drink alcohol, you shorten them. When you're under stress, you shorten them. We don't want that. Because every single organ in your body, your heart, your lungs, your brain, your eyes, your liver, your kidney, all of these have a biological clock. So we don't all age and die at the same way. You might have healthy lungs because you didn't smoke, but you may have a diseased liver because you took in a lot of carbohydrates, fructose and sugar, and now you have non-alcoholic fatty liver disease. That then becomes your weak link, and therefore your liver, which processes your toxins out of the body, conjugates them, gets them out, and brings in nutrients, and then breaks them down and reassembles them so the body can actually use them. Like if you take pantothenic acid, it has to be broken down and made into a different substance biochemically for the body to be able to utilize it. Vitamin C is converted into ascorbate. So just simple things like that. But that's assuming that your liver works right. Are you taking glutathione? You should be. Most important nutrient for your liver. Are you taking juices, especially green juices? Great for the liver. But apple and lemons, great for the liver. But if you're not, then you're going to prematurely age your liver. And all that fat you're eating, all the refined carbohydrates, speed up the degeneration of the liver. And you create all these senescent cells. Well, now we have what the researchers applied compounds, the what are called resveratrol analogs. These are simply chemicals on a substance naturally found in dark chocolate, red grapes, blueberries, to cells in culture. The chemicals cause splicing factors, which are progressively switched off as we age, to be switched back on again. Within hours, the cells looked younger and started to rejuvenate, behaving like young cells and dividing. Now, I knew this years ago when I started feeding nutrients. First, it was the whole food, like lots of berries, to rats in the laboratory. But then I started giving nutrients and their juices, and I started seeing rats live almost twice as long as normal within total health versus those that were separate, that were just using the standard rat chow. So, yeah, and then I started to apply what I learned in the lab into the human clinical protocols I was doing. And then from there, the 50 different clinical studies I've done. So just keep in mind, you want to live a longer life now in the anti-aging. And those of us, and those of you who've been following this advice, who've been using resveratrol since I mentioned it over 15 years ago, you're already younger. Even without knowing it, you're preventing diseases, you're preventing the senescence, you're preventing the aging clock from speeding up and the telomeres from shortening. How about that? So you are on the right side of that issue. And finally, I'm doing a major article and a documentary on cancer. I've done several in the past, but I'm very concerned that we should be changing radically, not all, but much of the way we approach cancer at the orthodox level. And the amount and types of chemotherapy we're using, based upon a real detailed analysis of the actual studies, shows that about half of people dying are dying not just from the cancer, but from the chemotherapy used to treat the cancer. That's an awful lot of deaths. That's hundreds of thousands a year. And yet not a word anywhere. No one criticizes it. Well, now it's being criticized. This is Ohio State University today. Chemotherapy helps breast cancer cells to spread and attach to blood vessel linings in the lungs. This is a new study and adds to the evidence that chemotherapy enhances cancer spread beyond the primary tumor, showing how one chemical or chemotherapy drug allows breast cancer cells to squeeze through and attach to blood vessel linings in the lungs. And this was a research that was in mice. It leaves no doubt that the chemotherapy drug caused changes to non-cancer cells to enable this process. So just something we should learn about. One last thing from University of Leeds, which is the United Kingdom. Long-term omega-3 fatty acid use, that's your fish oil, or walnuts and avocados and flaxseed, hemp seed, can protect those at risk of Alzheimer's disease. The longer you use the omega-3 fatty acids, the greater the association with reduced likelihood of developing late-stage Alzheimer's. And so this was published in the European Journal of Neurology. Oh, and by the way, shiitake mushrooms is now proven to benefit dozens of diseases. I'll get on to that on tomorrow's program. That's the latest on health and healing. We're going to take a break, and when we come back, we're going to hear from the professor. And by the way, her name is very familiar to Luann Panessi. It's also Panessi. And hear what she has to say. Because, mind you, she's orthodox. She's the professor of medical ethics. And she's calling out the establishment. Let's see if anyone in the mainstream media says, let's have her on. Let's have her debate. Let's question her. Back with her in a moment. Please stay with us.
I'm waiting for my speech to come up. That's why I'm pausing. So you might have to clap to get the guys. There we go. All right, well, I'm so glad to see everyone tonight. So think back to a couple of years ago, if you can, fall 2019, let's say. What were you doing then? What was your life like? What did you care about? What did you most fear? What did you imagine about the future? That's the person I would like to talk to for the next few minutes, and I'll begin with my own story. At the end, I'll have a favor to ask you and a little secret to share. In the fall of 2019, I was a professor of ethics and ancient philosophy. I taught students critical thinking and the importance of self-reflection, how to ask good questions and evaluate evidence, how to learn from the past, and why democracy requires civic virtue. Fast forward to September 16th, 2021, when I received a termination with cause letter after I questioned and refused to comply with my employer's vaccine mandate. I was dismissed for doing exactly what I had been hired to do. I was a professor of ethics, questioning what I take to be an unethical demand. You don't have to look very hard to see the irony. Canada is governed by laws which are based on ethics. You could say that ethics are the bedrock beneath our democracy. The right to determine what shall or shall not be done with one's own body and to be free from non-consensual medical treatment is a right deeply rooted in our common law. Those aren't my words. They're the words of Justice Sidney Robbins of the Ontario Court of Appeal. With very few exceptions, each person's body is considered inviolate in Canadian law. I should almost just stop there. And this is the underlying ethos of the Nuremberg Code, a promise to humanity that we would never again endorse uninformed, non-voluntary medical decision-making, even for the patient's own good, even for the sake of the public good. By definition, vaccine mandates are coercive immunization strategies. In the absence of coercion, the threat of the loss of employment, for example, people would voluntarily agree to do what the mandate is trying to achieve. Employers are holding our careers hostage and removing our participation in the economy and in public life. Their justification is that, well, we're in a pandemic, and we must therefore relinquish autonomy over our bodies for the sake of the public good. So let's talk about autonomy and the public good for a minute. In emergencies, the Parliament and provincial legislatures have a limited power to pass laws that violate certain charter rights for the sake of the public good. But to justify those violations, vaccine mandates would need to meet a very high threshold. COVID-19 would, for example, need to be a highly virulent pathogen for which there is no adequate treatment, and the vaccines would need to be demonstrably effective and safe. The current state of affairs in Canada meets neither of these criteria. Consider these facts. First, COVID-19 has an infection fatality rate not even 1% that of smallpox, and it poses even less risk to children. Second, a number of safe, highly effective pharmaceuticals exist to treat it, including monoclonal antibodies, ivermectin, fluvoxamine, vitamin D, and zinc. And third, the vaccines have reported more adverse events, including innumerable deaths, than every other vaccine on the market in the last 30 years. In light of these facts, I have so many questions. Why are the vaccinated granted vaccine passports and access to public spaces when the director of the CDC has stated that the COVID-19 vaccines cannot prevent transmission? Why is vaccination the only mitigation strategy when emerging evidence, including a recent Harvard study, this was in September of this year, shows no discernible relationship between the vaccination rate and new cases? No discernible relationship at all. Why does our government continue to withhold ivermectin as a recommended treatment when the U.S. National Institutes of Health supports it, and when the state of Uttar Pradesh in India distributed it to its 230 million people, reducing the COVID death rate to almost zero? How has India surpassed Canada in healthcare? Why are we about to vaccinate five-year-olds when COVID poses less risk to them than the potential vaccine reactions, and while there is no effective monitoring system for the vaccines? Why are we focused on the narrow benefits of vaccine-induced immunity when real-world studies show natural immunity is more protective, more potent, and more enduring? Why, maybe someone can give me an answer to this one, why do we shame the vaccine hesitant and not the vaccine adamant? Why, as a nurse recently asked, do the protected need to be protected from the unprotected by forcing the unprotected to use the protection that did not protect the protected in the first place? By every measure and from every angle, this is a house of cards about to crumble. But the question that interests me is, why hasn't it crumbled already? Why are these questions not the headlines of every major newspaper in Canada every single day? Have the right people simply not seen the right data? Is it just a clinical error on a global scale? What has happened to our leadership? Our Prime Minister leads the battle cry, "Don't think you're getting on a plane," he threatened. Campaign promises are now segregationist public policy. Our government encourages us daily to be divisive and hateful. How did things change so drastically? How did we Canadians change so drastically? It's my observation that we are facing a pandemic, not just of a virus, but a pandemic of compliance and complacency in a culture of silence, censorship, and institutionalized bullying. Mainstream media, you know, they like to say that we are fighting a war of information, that misinformation, even questioning and doubt, have plagued the pandemic. But it is not only information that is being weaponized in this war. It is a person's right to think for herself. I've heard it said that, well, I don't know very much about viruses, so I shouldn't really have an opinion. But the issue is not whether or not you know more about virology than our public health officials. The issue is, why aren't we calling them out for not being willing to engage with the evidence and debate someone who has a different opinion? We should be calling not for an outcome, but for a process to be reestablished. Without that process, we have no science, we have no democracy. Without that process, we are in a kind of moral war. But the wars of the past have had clear and distinct boundaries, the East and the West, the patriots and the government. And the war we find ourselves in today is one of infiltration instead of invasion, intimidation instead of free choice, of psychological forces that are so insidious we come to believe that the ideas are our own and that we are doing our part by giving up our rights. As a wise colleague recently put it, this is a war about the role of government, It is about our freedom to think and ask questions, and about whether individual autonomy can be downgraded to a conditional privilege or whether it remains a right. It is a war about whether you are to remain a citizen or become a subject. It is about who owns you, you or the state. It is about where we draw the line. This isn't about, you know, liberals and conservatives, pro and anti-vaxxers, experts and lay people. Everyone should care about the truth. Everyone should care about the scientific and democratic processes. Everyone should care about each other. There is, I would argue, little value in ensuring the survival of our nation if our freedom to debate, to criticize, to demand evidence for what our government asks of us does not survive with it. As someone born in the 70s, I never thought this would be a war I would have to fight. That the right to bodily autonomy, to the free and transparent exchange of information, would be at risk. Think for a minute about the most unimaginable harms of the last century, the Final Solution, South African apartheid, the Rwandan and Cambodian genocides. Aren't we supposed to remember the atrocities of the past so we don't repeat them? Well, memories are short. Family chains are broken, new worries eclipse the old ones, and the lessons of the past fade into ancient history only to be forgotten. Today, the vaccinated seem to enjoy all the rights and privilege of a civilized society: freedom of movement, access to education, the approval of governments, lawmakers, journalists, friends, and family. Vaccination is the ticket to a conditional return of our right to participate in Canadian society. But as John F. Kennedy said, the rights of every man are diminished when the rights of one man are threatened. I have no doubt that COVID-19 is the greatest threat to humanity we have ever faced. Not because of a virus. That is just one chapter of a much longer, more complex story. But because of our response to it. And that response is, I believe, earning its place in every single medical ethics textbook that will be published in the next century. What can we do? As Canadian chemist and author Orlando Batista said, an error doesn't become a mistake until you refuse to correct it. In our world, politeness, getting by, flying under the radar seem to be the goals. Gone are the 60s revolutionaries, gone are the patriots of early America. We are the victims and the soldiers of a pandemic of compliance. But compliance is not a virtue. It isn't neutral, and it certainly isn't harmless. When Hannah Arendt covered the trial of Adolf Eichmann for The New Yorker in 1961, she expected to find a complex, arrogant, diabolical, perhaps psychotic man. What she found was quite the opposite. She was struck by his very ordinariness. He was terribly and terrifyingly normal, she wrote. A man who was just following orders, as he said over and over again. What she found was what she called the banality of evil, the thoughtless tendency of ordinary people to obey orders in order to conform without thinking for themselves. The dismissive, well-rehearsed messaging of our public health officials has created a highly efficient machine that does not publish its evidence or engage in debate, but only issues orders that we obligingly follow. With the help of the media, its mistakes are hidden, its policies unquestioned, its dissenters silenced. How do we break this silence? How do we regain our sanity and rebuild our democracy? Perhaps it's time to get a little bit noisy. Studies have proven that once an idea, yes. Yeah. Studies have proven that once an idea is adopted by just 10% of the population, that is the tipping point when ideas, opinions, and beliefs will be rapidly adopted by the rest. So a vocal, a noisy 10% is all it takes.
Yes!
Democracy, which comes from a couple of Greek words. There's some ancient philosophy for you tonight. Democracy, which means rule of the people, doesn't just allow for freedom of expression and inquiry. It requires it. And the little secret I promised you at the beginning, here it is. You aren't a bad person for demanding evidence. You aren't a bad person for trusting your instincts. And you aren't a bad person for wanting to think for yourself. In fact, the opposite is true. If you are worried about a loss of justice, if you are worried about what kinds of lives will be possible for our children, if you want your country back, the country that was once the envy of the world, then now is the time to act. There is no reason to wait. There is no luxury or excuse to wait. We need you now. Now is the time to call your politicians and write to our newspapers. Now is the time to protest. Now is the time to challenge and even disobey our governments. As Margaret Mead said, never doubt that a small group of thoughtful, committed citizens can change the world. Indeed, it is the only thing that ever has. In other words, you don't need a tribe of heroes, a mass of heroes, a country of heroes. You only need one. You can do your part and you can make a difference. The Southwest Airlines pilots, the Canadian Mounties, the university health work nurses are all making a difference. And the favor I have to ask you, we need heroes now more than ever. Our democracy is asking for volunteers. Will you be a hero for our country, for our children? Will you be part of the noisy 10%?
Now let's go to Bill Maher, New Rule.
And finally, new rule. From now on, when Joe Biden veers off into one of his long-winded stories that seem to be off topic, everyone must realize he usually does have a point.
But those of you who are over 50, how often did you ever see advertisements on television with black and white couples? Not a joke. I challenge you, find today, when you turn on the stations, sit on one station for 2 hours, and I don't know how many commercials you'll see, lay 8 to 5. 2 to 3 out of 5 have mixed race couples in them.
I'm going to tell you, I know it sounds kind of out of left field, but actually Uncle Joe is pointing liberals towards something they need to be more aware of. They have a bad case of progressive phobia. That's the phrase coined by Steven Pinker to describe a brain disorder that strikes liberals and makes them incapable of recognizing progress. It's like situational blindness, only what you can't see is that your dorm in 2021 is better than the South before the Civil War. If you think America is more racist now than ever, more sexist than before women could vote, and more homophobic than when blowjobs were a felony, you have progressophobia and should adjust your mask because it's covering your eyes. You know, before 2012, every time gay marriage was put before a state's voters, it lost. 35 times in a row. Now it's the law of the land in every state. Even half of Republicans are for it. The other half are for closeted gay sex. The chant from gay protesters used to be, "We're here, we're queer, get used to it." Well, we did. This is Pride Month, and it's not even a big deal anymore. 30 days of parades and festivals celebrating a cause that was once so divisive, Ellen had to pretend to be straight. State houses fly pride flags now. Disney celebrates it. By federal law, every single TV show must include a storyline about lesbians having a baby. If someone announces they're gay on TV, it's met with thunderous applause. My accountant says, Yas Queen. You literally can't find a major American corporation that doesn't do something for Pride Month. NASCAR does it. Raytheon, maker of high-tech lethal weaponry that kills people from the sky, does it. And I hear next year they're going to paint You Go Girl on the side of their missile. And it's not just LGBT issues. Not that long ago, I knew people who went to prison for growing pot. And today you can legally smoke it for fun in 43% of the country, and I will. Even something like bullying, it still happens. But being outwardly cruel to people who are different is no longer acceptable. That's progress. And acknowledging progress isn't saying we're done or we don't need more. And being gloomier doesn't make you a better person. In 1958, only 4% of Americans approved of interracial marriage. Now, Gallup doesn't even bother asking. The last time they did in 2013, 87% approve. An overwhelming majority of Americans now say they want to live in a multiracial neighborhood. That is a sea change from when I was a kid. In a country that's 14% black, 18% of the incoming class of Harvard is black. And since 2017, white students are not even a majority in our public colleges. Employees of color make up 47% of Microsoft, 50% of Target, 55% of The Gap, as companies become desperate to look like their TV commercials. The Friends reunion we just had looked weird. Because if you even suggested a show today about six people, all of whom were straight and white, the network would laugh you out of the room and then cancel you on Twitter. And yet there is a recurrent theme on the far left that things have never been worse. Kevin Hart expressed a view many hold when he told the New York Times, "You're witnessing white power and white privilege at an all-time high." This is one of the big problems with wokeness, that what you say doesn't have to make sense or jibe with the facts, or ever be challenged, lest the challenge itself be conflated with racism. But saying white power and privilege is at an all-time high is just ridiculous. Higher than a century ago, the year of the Tulsa race massacre? Higher than the years when the KKK rode unchecked and Jim Crow went unchallenged? Higher than the 1960s when the Supremes and Willie Mays still couldn't stay in the same hotel as the white people they were working with? Higher than during slavery? And I mean actual slavery, not Prince doesn't like his record contract slavery. Racism is still, unfortunately, still with us. We have the footage. In policing, housing, job discrimination, segregated schools, wealth inequality, the legacy of injustice sadly lives on and demands remedial action. I understand, as best I can, how racism singes a person's soul so much that they might see it everywhere. But seeing clearly is necessary for actually fixing problems, and clearly racism is simply no longer everywhere. It's not in my home, and it probably isn't in yours, if I read my audience right, and I think I do. For most of the country, the most unhip thing you could ever be today is a racist. Even Derek Chauvin was not backed up by his fellow officers, and that never used to happen. The low point of race relations wasn't Kim Kardashian wearing cornrows, even though it happened on Snapchat and George Wallace standing in a doorway didn't. Because here's the thing, kids. There actually was a world before you got here. We date human events, AD and BC, but we need a third marker for millennials and Gen Z. BY, before you. It's telling that in a recent Harvard youth poll of Americans between 18 and 29, 72% of blacks said they were hopeful about the future of America, as compared to only 46% of whites. I'm not surprised. There are a hell of a lot of Americans trying really hard these days to embrace a new spirit of inclusion and self-reflection, and this progressive allergy to acknowledging societal advances is self-defeating, because progress and hope that we can achieve it is the product we're selling. And having a warped view of reality leads to policies that are warped. Black-only dorms and graduation ceremonies, a growing belief in whiteness as a malady and white people as irredeemable, giving up on a colorblind society. Only if you believe we've made no progress does any of that make sense. I can name some things that actually are worse than they've ever been before, like the environment and homelessness in LA and the prospects for maintaining an actual democracy in America. But where progress has been made, it's not a sin, and it's certainly not inaccurate to say, we've come a long way, baby. Not mission accomplished, just a long way.
A lot of variety today. I always like it. Now, some good information that we can all use right now, but you can't just do good things. You've got to pay attention to people who are doing bad things, because if they get the power of the purse, if they get the power of the legislation, if they control the judicial system, which is utterly and completely corrupt from top to bottom, I wouldn't trust a single thing anyone said out of any federal agency, because they lie. Yeah, they lie about everything. All right. That's why you got to know where not to step in life, because you could be stepping on one of their controlled emotional minefields. So from the National Heart, Lung, and Blood Institute comes a study that drinking sufficient water could prevent heart failure. Now that's good news. So staying well hydrated throughout life can reduce the risk of developing heart failure. This is from the lead scientist, quote, "Our study suggests that maintaining good hydration can prevent or at least slow down the changes within the heart that lead to heart failure." And this is from a Dr. Dmitriev. And that's good. That means between 1.6 and 2.1 liters for women and 2 to 3 liters for men. That does not take into account if you're exercising outside and losing a lot of water. Then you have to compensate for that too. So by having plenty of fluids, it also thins out the blood, making you less susceptible to the aggregation of red blood cells, which can lead to clots. So one very important thing that helps us. I want to thank you all for listening. Please go to GaryNall.com to look at all the articles and videos and other information that can help you make the better choices in your life. Have a nice day.